First, I really want to thank you for letting me participate in this beautiful moving service, Shabbos service. Last time I was at JRC was about 25 years ago, and my cousin Annie Byers bat mitzvah here. And I finally remember what a special place JRC was then, and all that it meant also to my Aunt Bonnie, who joins us today after many years. It's a real honor to be back. I'm really humbled that Melissa Mizell, reached out to me and asked me to share some of our experiences. I'm also, though, grateful to JRC not having some of the courage and the leadership when Tikkun Olam was spoken about to support difficult conversations like these about truly vexing issues and issues that couldn't be more dear to my heart about fundamental questions of equal justice and law enforcement and police for everybody. And I'm even more grateful that this won't just be an opportunity for me to talk about the issues, but I hope that we can also talk about concrete things that we can do. And I want to start really by sharing some of the lessons that we learned from our children. I guess first, let me just give you a little bit of background on our clinic. Melissa asked me to talk a little bit about what we do. Until the housing projects were torn down and entire communities were disappeared in Chicago, my law students and I worked from the ground floor of public housing high-rise community called Stateway Gardens. It made up about 8 square blocks of Chicago's South Side, about a 10-minute drive from the law school where I work, and it became our second home for about 7 years or so. State Street Corridor, and that's where Stateway sat, made up the largest concentration of public housing and indeed poverty in our entire nation. 10 and 17-story high-rise buildings filled with thousands of Chicago's poorest families struggling to survive. You could see that stretch of towers, and you all who are from Chicago, you could see it right off the interstate that divided some of Chicago's ethnic communities from public housing, the ongoing racial divide also that still exists today here in Chicago. Everybody who lived at Stateway where we worked was black. Residents had trashed out for us a vacant apartment unit that had been a haven for illegal drug activity, and folks converted into productive working space for my students and I and other service providers. We became, for those years, really de facto squatters. And from that post, we worked together with a writer and dear friend, human rights activist, you also may have heard a lot about recently, Jamie Calvin. And we built together a pretty robust human rights documentation project, an advocacy project that we called the Stateway Civil Rights Project. We documented what we saw, what we heard, what we felt, what we experienced on the ground in those 8 square blocks. While we didn't initially conceive of what we were doing as, even though I was a lawyer, law professor, as a litigation project, we wound up bringing around 6 pretty major civil rights suits based on our experiences there. One that arose after there was a massive police raid on a nighttime public housing basketball tournament that had received national acclaim for promoting peace and community. About 50 officers had stormed into the gym, imprisoned the 300 adults and kids who were there, and subjected everybody from moms with their babies, young children, older folks, to even the basketball players in their gym shorts, to invasive searches of their bodies, their stuff. And then we brought another case to try to stop a group of officers that were widely known in public housing as the Skullcap Crew from their repeated racist and sadistic sexual abuse of a 50-year-old mom who worked as a public school janitor, someone who became a dear friend of ours. And yet another, just to give you a sense of some of the horrific things that we did see and experience there, of another dear friend, Pete, who was a working man who worked with us. 3 police officers, after leaving Pete's autistic young daughter outside alone in the dark, then handcuffed Pete's hands behind his back while they menaced him with a live chainsaw as they took a chainsaw to his head. While the work that we did was intensely local, each of these cases arose, as I said, within just these 8 square blocks of the South Side. A number of them raised broad questions and brought attention to the ways that we still lack fundamental equal justice in America. At the same time when we were doing this, we also worked side by side with folks in the neighborhood to try to build constructive programs, to build work programs, sports, community stuff, to provide opportunities and also to some alternatives to drug trade that was the single biggest economic opportunity, if you can call it an opportunity, that existed at Stateway. A number of my students and I now for a good part of the last 4 years, we spent talking, and probably not just talking, more importantly, listening to inner city high school students about their experiences with the police. See, Rich Hare, his son Aaron, worked close with us on the same project before he left for New York. Aaron Cahan, something we called the Youth Police Project. And our project rests on the fundamental premise that the young folks most affected by urban police practices possess critical knowledge and perspectives that all too often are absent in our conversations here about these issues. And simply put, that kids closest to the ground know stuff that some of us just don't know. So after we did a bunch of workshops, South Side, West Side, high schools, we immersed ourselves for about the last 2.5 years or so in a school called High Park Academy, which is just about 4 or 5 blocks from the law school where I teach. High Park High made national news just a few years ago when the president visited. President Obama had come to town, y'all remember, shortly after 15-year-old Hadiyah Pendleton was killed, shot and killed within blocks of his home. While we were talking with kids at High Park Academy, we've heard terrible stories of abuse, like some of the stories I just shared or alluded to. But while we've heard those stories, our focus was on the countless interactions that kids and police had every day, their everyday experiences, their normal experiences. And our methodology was just truly simple. We asked black high school students to talk with us about their experiences, their interactions with the police, and we listened. I'd like to highlight 4 of the lessons that we learned from the kids before we talk about some of their implications and what that may mean for the change. First thing that really jumped out to my students and I was that there was a completely different constitution that governed kids in black neighborhoods than the same constitution that we teach in our law school classrooms. In contrast to most of my students and most of my law students at the University of Chicago, the high school kids see police as ubiquitous presences in their neighborhoods. They live with the ever-present possibility of being stopped, searched by police, encounters in which kids feel that the police have all the power. High schoolers described as routine to us these hostile encounters in which officers command kids to put their hands against the wall, spread their legs to be searched. And everything about those encounters, from the officer's swagger, their gait, their tone of voice, appears from the kids' perspectives to convey a message of power, authority, trying to inspire fear. As Richard said, they're over you, you're under them. Therefore, you don't even matter. What struck us was that young black folks expect to be treated with the suspicion of being a criminal. That's how most black kids where we've worked think of them. They can't imagine anything different. Like, that's just the way it is. That is their normal. In contrast, we interviewed over 100 kids at the lab school at U of C, where one of my daughters attends. It's an elite, predominantly white high school affiliated with the university, just 5 blocks from Hyde Park High. Not a single kid reported ever having been stopped or searched by a police officer in their lives. Second thing we learned from the kids was Probably the most important lesson was the primacy of accountability. Most powerful thing we heard, or we just learned from our work with kids, was that, or is that, young people won't trust police unless they're held accountable. The unifying theme that was articulated in one form or another by virtually every kid who we spoke with was the police have all the power. They have all the power. That knowledge of that unchecked power informed every encounter they had. Every young black man stopped by police knew that this quote-unquote routine encounter, this routine stop, has the power to escalate into something far worse, a false arrest, years in prison, brutality, even death. Virtually every young black man and woman on Chicago South Side who we spoke with, and we spoke with hundreds and hundreds, has a friend or a family member who's been beat, tased, arrested, or even shot at the hands of police. That's also a part of our kids' everyday reality. In the wake of Ferguson, President Obama convened a task force, a national task force on policing, and he made a series of recommendations for police reform in America. And most of its recommendations are based on what social scientists call procedural justice, which is just basically the critical importance of making people feel like they're being treated fairly, respectfully, that's critical to building legitimacy, police legitimacy, to building trust. My friend Tracy Mears, who's a law professor from Yale, she was the primary author of that task force for the president, and she appropriately calls this rightful policing. What the high school students showed us and taught us was that rightful policing also has to include accountability or it's not going to be effective. Without honesty and accountability, the police won't be seen as fair, they won't be seen as legitimate, and they won't be seen as just. Black students taught us that that unchecked power not only informs every encounter, but it also eclipses the positive stuff. We heard about courteous and even friendly encounters between police and kids, and that didn't change their basic perceptions, the kinds of perceptions I wasn't cherry-picking the comments that you heard. Those were representative, while just I showed you a few minutes, they were representative of what we heard time and again from kids who are going to high school, in school. Those same kids, though, shared plenty of encouraging stories, a lot of encouraging stories, consistent with the task force's notion of rightful policing. Good officers greeted kids, treated them with respect. Officers treated people fairly. But at the same time, when a kid saw officer friendly or officer righteous smile and greet a kid, officer not so righteous was harassing some other kids right across the street, shaking down kids on their block. And the kids would see those officers come back again and again. Nothing would happen to them. When kids see officers abuse their friends, neighbors without fear of punishment, that says a lot more to them about the department than that neighborhood officer that greets them with a smile. To most kids, it made that smile feel like a lie. Kids told us, and this is the words they use, they talk about the real police. The real police aren't the police, the officers who try to talk nice and be nice to them, but the real police are the ones, to them, they say, those are the ones who are protected by the department. That's who the real police are. It didn't matter that 90% of the officers, and it's true, 90% of the officers in their neighborhoods were not doing this mess, weren't doing dirt, but that if everyone protects those abusive officers, they become the face of the department to our children, not officer friendly, not officer righteous. Think about like what Hassante, that was a young man with the dreads, said. Ain't no such thing as positive encounters. No such thing as a good encounter with police. Third, our kids' experiences with stop and frisk. That further undermines even the possibility of building trust. While the stops that kids experience are anything but, and I describe them and some of the kids describe them, are anything but courteous and respectful, imagine even the most courteous stops in the world, and they still wouldn't change the unmistakable message that kids get when they're stopped by police, the message that we think that you look like a criminal. And that's the honest, if we're going to be honest with one another, that's the intended message. Because we're not even allowed to stop you unless we have, under the law, a reasonable belief that you've committed a crime. And we're not allowed to search you unless we have a reasonable belief that you're armed and dangerous. So no matter how respectful we are, when we stop and we search a child, we're telling that child that we think that he or she looks like a dangerous criminal. Our work taught me how that matters, how deeply, and it's hard not to see it even when I watch these few clips, how deeply kids are affected by this. Affected not just by being stopped, but just the normalcy. You know, that's what shocked my students, that this was just normal. This is every day. Damage to their self-esteem, view of themselves, their place in the world, their friends, as Jamari told us very poignantly, they make you feel like less than a person. How the ever-present possibility of being stopped caused kids to curtail their own freedom. And I have teenagers too, so I see them, you know, at a most critical time in their development. And kids would use all these coping mechanisms. Don't go outside. Don't walk alone. Don't walk in groups. Just how it cramps their horizons. In addition, many kids rightfully view the practice of being stopped and searched as fundamentally unfair when it's in play only in certain neighborhoods and with certain populations and not others. That's a practice that's been reserved for the black, brown, and poor folk among us and the neighborhoods where we live. Think about that. It's pretty difficult to forge trusting relationships in that context. Final observation I'll share before talking about its implications is the one that still strikes me the most, because more than anything, I've been struck by just how alienated kids are from police. Their fundamental distrust. That, more than anything, I mean, whether or not we agreed with each and every one of the perspectives of the kids, and we didn't, but that, more than anything, tells me we need to do something different. Got to do something better, that this is not working if the majority of our children do not trust law enforcement. And that alienation has practical consequences as well in terms of all of our safety. It makes it harder for cops, officers to solve crimes. Kids who don't trust police certainly aren't speaking to them when something goes down. Recall Anaya, if something ever happened, if I was ever to get into something, the police would be, as she said, the last people I would call. Our young people don't feel safe stepping up as witnesses, reluctant to even talk with the police, much less provide information about criminal activity. Many told us that they wouldn't even, there would be these pregnant pauses because they would know, they'd be like, they know when I said, would you call the police if this? Would you call the police if that? And they knew the answer that I wanted them to say is, yes, of course I call the police. But kids told us they wouldn't even call the police when someone close to them was assaulted. They often told us they would go to others and not necessarily the folks who we all would hope the kids would go to protect them. When we studied citywide data, we saw the same thing. We observed that the neighborhoods that had the greatest number of complaints of police abuse were the very same areas that had the lowest clearance rates for solving crime, violent crime. Just like kids taught us, police were least successful at solving crime in the neighborhoods and places where they had the least trust. So what do we do about this? I mean, how do we address these fundamental issues that have caused so many of our children to distrust law enforcement? You know, in moments of political crises like these, there's a tendency to look for that hot new elixir, that magical potion that is going to just fix everything. Body cameras, right? That's what we hear. It's that magical cure-all that allows us to say problem solved, but still while underlying issues remain unaddressed. So one of the things that my medical friends teach me, we never have effective remedies unless you get the diagnosis right. So let's be clear about what kids taught us about the fundamental nature of the disease. Institutional denial, secrecy, absence of police accountability, racism. That's what we're up against. That's the core causes behind the distrust. So in our experience, at least, it takes three fundamental things if we're going to even think about earning the trust of our children. And that's honesty, accountability, and basic respect. Respect for folks' dignity. It all starts with honesty. It starts with acknowledging the reality of experience of folks in some of our country's most marginalized communities. Acknowledging our kids' realities. Just that simple. Everything else feels like a lie if we keep denying that our kids' experiences aren't real. The reality is, we stop, search, arrest, kill far more people, police, in the United States than law enforcement in any other nation in the world. And the reality is also that we stop, search, arrest, and kill black folks at far greater rates than white folks. Most police departments in the United States don't publish police misconduct data. And among the minority that do, there hasn't been any attempt to develop national uniform standards that would permit any meaningful comparison from departments, say, in St. Louis to that in Chicago. We don't even keep reliable data when people are shot and killed by police. And that's just inexcusable. There was a recent report that I read in ProPublica drawing on the admittedly unreliable FBI data that do exist. And it found that young black men were 21 times more likely than their white counterparts to be shot by police in America. The Washington Post also published a study and found similarly black men far more likely to be shot, killed by police than whites. Our backyard, Chicago. Since 1986, Chicago police officers have shot, on average, one person a week, 30 years straight. If we count the misses, because one of the things I learned that actually our officers aren't such good shots, they've shot at over 150 people a year. More than 75% of those folks who are shot, black. In my lifetime, we've seen hundreds of black folks shot by police in Chicago, but until just a couple months ago when the state's attorney brought criminal charges against police officer Jason Van Dyke for the murder of Laquan McDonald, a high school student shot 16 times, caught on video. There hadn't been a single instance in which an on-duty Chicago police officer had ever been prosecuted in my entire lifetime for shooting a black man, woman, or child, ever. And now, acknowledging the realities of young black people means passing a law that requires every single police department in this nation to collect and report standardized information about encounters between individuals and police. Police shootings, citizen complaints, street and traffic stops. Honesty means we share the truth about who's being stopped, who's being subjected to force, who's being killed. It also means having honest conversations about why. Why police are stopping and searching a heck of a lot more black and brown folk than white folks. Why are police killing so many more black folks than white folks in America? And what, if anything, should we do about that? Denying our kids' realities, just telling them, no, that doesn't happen, you deny that, that guarantees that we never earn any of these kids' trust, any of our children's trust, much less their cooperation or their partnership. Most of y'all probably hadn't heard of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald before last Thanksgiving. That video of his killing sparked national attention, protests. While few folks took notice, he was actually killed back in October 2014. And back when Laquan was killed, there was just a short blotter in the press drawn from a police narrative that read, it reads like hundreds of others. Squad car responds to a call. Someone's trying to break into cars in the area. Officers find a boy with a knife in the street. He ignores their command to drop the knife. He lunges at the officer with the knife, putting the officer in fear for his life. And then the officer shoots him once in the chest in self-defense. Stories like these appear in Chicago media several times a month. Police shoot people on average once a week. Several times a month, I read this story in the paper. So common that they rarely, if ever, command our attention. All of us now know what really happened. Before Officer Van Dyke, though, drove up on that scene, to me, the officers out there, for the most part, were doing the right thing. They're doing what you'd hope well-trained officers would do in a similar situation. You got a 17-year-old kid. He has a small knife. He slashed the tires of a police car. He looks like he's kind of out of it, like he's in a daze, not responding to commands, police commands to drop the knife. No doubt the officers had the right to arrest him, or better yet, maybe take him to a hospital, because he was clearly in need of some help. But he didn't pose an immediate threat to anyone at this time. He's walking in a mostly abandoned industrial area, 9:30 at night, shut down. There's a shopping center being built on the other side of a construction fence. All the workers have long since gone. No pedestrians out on the street. So the officers do the right thing. They follow him, slowly, on foot, and in a car, going just a couple miles an hour, right? They're close enough so that if he does pose a threat to anyone, they can act, but far enough away that he doesn't pose an immediate threat to them. This is the stuff that we try to train police to do. It's good stuff. At the same time, they're doing something else that's right, which is calling for some help, calling for backup. Would have liked them to be calling also other officers trained to work with people who are emotionally disturbed to try to talk them down, but they were calling for backup, trying even to get a taser to expand ways that they may be able to bring them in safely. That goes on for a few minutes, following them slowly. Then you get Officer Van Dyke and his partner bust up on the scene. Decide to be cowboys, forget this mess. Pull the car right close to Laquan. Van Dyke jumps out the car, gun drawn. As Laquan tries to shy away toward that construction fence, Van Dyke shoots him, dropping the boy to the ground. And here's something you don't know from just watching the video, because curiously, there's no sound. And I know y'all have read a lot about why there's no sound. Van Dyke pauses, and every person who was there, who we spoke with, told me there's a pause after the boy fell to the ground. He then, as that boy lay there, fires a barrage of bullets, emptying his chamber into Laquan's body as he lay there on the street. There's a woman outside, and she's repeatedly screaming, "Stop shooting! Stop shooting!" as Van Dyke pumps 16 rounds into the boy's body. You gotta call a duck sometimes. And as the people who witnessed this shooting have told me, this was an execution. Van Dyke shot that boy like he was a dog in the street. While there are, as I said, lots of police shootings in Chicago, this really is extraordinary. Stuff like this does not happen every day or every week. But while what Officer Van Dyke did was not just wrong, but truly extraordinary, the police department's attempts immediately afterwards to let's circle the wagons, cover up what happened, is sadly anything but extraordinary. What stands out even to the most casual observer was just how normal that is. Even after every officer seemed to have been doing everything right just before that, suddenly the life of a 17-year-old black kid mattered a lot less than protecting and covering for a fellow officer. Code of silence immediately takes place, goes into effect after the shooting. Entire world is seen. Now what the police department's machinery of denial, what that looks like, how it operates. Officers immediately, they intimidate the witnesses who are there, shoo them away. Not let me get your name, let me get your contact information, tell me what happened. It was get the hell out of here. One of the witnesses refuses to leave. That was the woman who was screaming, stop shooting. So they take her back to the station. She says that a couple detectives then lock her in a room, hold her there against her will for 6 hours, intimidate her and tell her that she didn't see what she saw, that she didn't see that officer repeatedly shoot Laquan as he lay on the ground. And contrary to the actual witness reports, if you read the official police reports, and they're available to read, each of them says that every witness on the scene, they didn't see a doggone thing. There's a Burger King that's across the street, kitty corner from where this happened. And Burger King's 13 security cameras actually captured the events, not the actual shooting, but the events that led up to the shooting and immediately thereafter. Different angles, 13 separate video files. Within minutes of the shooting, a group of officers barge into the BK and they demand the password, they demand access to the surveillance footage. The manager of Burger King reports that the officers then wipe 86 minutes of video from the store's hard drive, crucial minutes before and after the shooting. They erase not just one, but all 13 of those files. One thing, in a moment of poetic justice, guess what? There's surveillance cameras in the BK running, and they videotape the officers actually erasing the video. That video exists. Official narrative of single-shot self-defense shared with the press. Every police officer, virtually every police officer on the scene lies. They either say Van Dyke shot Laquan in self-defense as Laquan lunged him with a knife, or they say they saw nothing. Indeed, there was an officer who was sitting in the front seat of the car, the same car with the video camera that shooting occurred right in front of her, and she said, "I was looking down the whole time, never looked up from my clipboard, didn't see anything." Prosecutor reports that fusillade of shots of those, the last 14 shots took at least 15 seconds. Never looked up. Notwithstanding their knowledge of the definitive video evidence from the police dashboard camera that captured this, and notwithstanding the 16 gunshot wounds that riddled Laquan's body, every single police supervisor and commander who reviewed this signed off on the official narrative of a shot in self-defense and reported shooting completely justified. Signed, sealed, delivered in the official police reports, available for everybody to see. Despite our calls and even our Freedom of Information Act lawsuits, just please release this, tell us the truth. The department clung to this false narrative and hid the truth from everybody for another 13 months until a court ruled that the police lacked any lawful justification whatsoever for suppressing that video and then ordered the release of the video. The entire world's now seeing that the department's official narrative lied. Let me ask you this. How's denial and secrecy working? How's that really been working for the department? Laquan could have been a classmate of any one of those kids. Is there any wonder why our kids aren't trusting the police? Honesty demands, they demand that police departments share information when a police officer shoots somebody or is accused of brutality or misconduct. I mean, basically, this is what we teach our kids. All trusting relationships are built on honesty. I mean, this is what Kenyatta and I teach our daughters. Don't trust people and don't get into relationships with people who lie to you. It's just that simple. Be honest with people. Keep people informed about the progress of your investigation. If you got a video, release it within 24 to 48 hours. That's what effective police departments are doing in this country. Imagine, though, how young people in Chicago might see police differently if the department had just been honest from the very beginning. It's honesty, just the first step. Second, while our conversations have to start with honesty, they also got to end with accountability. Ensuring that our officers are held accountable when they abuse their power to hurt people. Our children need to see that we don't stand behind and we don't protect abusive police, that we instead stand behind the real police. And the real police are the thousands of good officers who serve us with honor. And that means implementing credible systems to investigate and punish police misconduct, credible systems to address patterns of abuse, credible systems to address that code of silence that we're talking about. Patterns of abuse. As a matter of policy, and this is true not just Chicago, but around the nation, most departments refuse to look at evidence of patterns of complaints of abuse when investigating misconduct. They don't look at it proactively and certainly don't look at it reactively. And that's just indefensible, and it has to stop. It shouldn't have taken 20 complaints against Officer Jason Van Dyke, most of them for brutality against black folks, at least one for racial and ethnic slurs. Three shootings. One is first. Three shootings. Prior $500,000 police brutality verdict, meaning a court found him guilty of brutality, violating another black man's civil rights, $5 million settlement, and a court order to release a video of the execution of a 17-year-old boy before Van Dyke was finally held accountable. If we actually looked at patterns, Quan might be with us. 17-year-old kid didn't have to die. Right now, and Josh mentioned this in the intro, there are police unions fighting in Chicago to destroy police misconduct records that are more than 5 years old. If they have their way, there's going to be a bonfire of records. We can't investigate ongoing patterns of abuse if the records don't exist. We don't earn our children's trust by destroying evidence of patterns of abuse. So here's a no-brainer, the low-hanging fruit. There's a bill right now pending in Illinois, and this is something everybody should support, making a simple amendment to what we call our Local Records Act. And that just says, don't destroy these records. Retain them. Let's not let the very evidence that could save another child's life go up in smoke. We can't expect them to trust police if we cover things up, if we lie to them, if we protect the officers who abuse our children, their families, and their neighbors. We simply got to address the police code of silence. Mike and Monica, a couple police officers I got to know back at Stateway. Hot summer day, they're walking down from one of the 17-story high-rise buildings, and they notice an older man who they know from the neighborhood. He's wobbling, he's riding his bike on a sidewalk between, in the middle of this grass, hot summer day where neighborhood kids are playing tag. Mike and Monica then see another police car, two officers from what used to be the department's most elite unit, something called the Special Operations Section. And they see this car barrel across the front lawn, directly toward the kids. They scatter, beeline right for the old man on the bike, pinning the man between wire fence, police car, bent bike. He's dazed, he's out of it. Mike and Monica look on as the driver of that car gets out of the car and then just beats on the old man as he stays trapped between the car and the fence. In front of all those kids, too, Mike and Monica are pissed. They run over toward the two police officers, and they begin yelling. They're like, what the hell are you doing? We got to work here every day. You're going to get us all killed here. And they get into a shoving match with the other two officers. And I talked with Mike and Monica just a couple days after this. But as appalled as they were with what happened, Mike and Monica are never going to report what they saw. Because they know what it would mean. If they reported what they saw, that's the end of their careers of police in Chicago, and it could mean their lives. As much as they want to help, they can't. It's their jobs, their families, their lives. Vast majority of police, Chicago and around the nation, hate this stuff just as much as Mike and Monica. Most officers aren't out here beating old men on their bikes or abusing our kids. Indeed, it's become a truism among police chiefs in America that 10% of our officers cause about 90% of our problems. Chicago's no different. As much as you've seen about police abuse in Chicago, reality also is that most Chicago police officers haven't received a single abuse complaint in their entire careers. But silent majority don't feel that they can do anything about that few percent who've been allowed to abuse the most vulnerable among us with doggone near impunity. Nothing happened to those two officers I told you about. Supervisors came on the scene, cleaned up the scene, covered for them. They took the old man away in cuffs, falsely charged him. The driver, within 5 years, the next 5 years, 87 official complaints of misconduct. One man. His partner, another 30. I just told you, most police officers, zero in their entire careers. Both still on the force, never been disciplined for this. Back to patterns for a second, because this was a few years back. Josh talked about this data that we just released, last 4.5 years of data regarding every police abuse complaint in Chicago. Last 4.5 years, guess who has the second most police brutality complaints just within the last 4.5 years? Same guy. I guess I did forget. One thing did happen. He got promoted. He's a detective now. Many folks don't realize, though, that it was someone within law enforcement who had the courage to call and tell me about what had happened to Laquan McDonald. I mean, if I didn't get that call, if someone within law enforcement hadn't had the courage to call, we may not be having, or I know we wouldn't be having this conversation today. They told me about the video. They walked me through it frame by frame. Begged me to please, please, Craig, to do something about this. Keep this video from being buried. Don't let the dash cam video go the way of the Burger King surveillance tape. Please help share the truth and just stop this mess. What about these officers? What about these officers who do have the courage to bring this stuff to light? One of the things I do national police trainings, and we talk about ethics, we talk about the code of silence, we try to have honest conversations. We don't try, we have some honest conversations. And I often ask police and leaders at these trainings, and while some can tell me about instances, powerful instances in which an officer has broken the code of silence and all the good it's done for the department, how it's uncovered corruption, brutality, how it's led to major reforms, even the Serpico made for TV movies. But I often ask police at this training, can you give me a good example of a happy ending for the officer who had the courage to come forward? Only two people have raised their hands in all the talks I've given, speaking with now thousands of officers around the nation who represent thousands of departments. That's got to change. And here's what we got to do. It starts by admitting we got a problem. We can't address the code of silence if we don't acknowledge that it exists. It was truly historic when Mayor Rahm Emanuel in Chicago took the podium a couple months ago and admitted that we have a code of silence in Chicago. Not simply a relic of the past, not simply a case of this is a few bad apples, but a current, serious, and systemic problem. Got to talk the talk. Police leaders got to send a strong message to the young officers from the very beginning of their careers as cadets. This message isn't going to be tolerated. Prepare officers for real ethical challenges that they're going to face, and they will face them. But it's not just talking the talk, then it's walking the walk. Lead by example. First, the carrot, protect and honor officers who expose corruption and abuse. Empower officers to report anonymously outside the chain of command. Protect them when they come forward. If they consent, honor the officers who actually expose this abuse. Hold them out as the heroes that they are. I mean, I ask the same question, can you give me an example where one of those officers got one of those medals of valor that you give for solving other crimes? Then the stick. You retaliate against an officer who reports abuse, you retaliate against anyone who reports abuse, you're fired and referred for criminal prosecution. No questions asked. That's what we do. That's what needs to happen. You lie to protect a fellow officer, you're fired. That's simple. Create a culture where the abusive officers are afraid of the good ones and not vice versa. Because when our kids and their families see the department's machinery of accountability work the way it's supposed to work, confidence in police grow, and with that trust comes real cooperation, assistance, and with that trust comes a lot more effective police departments. Finally, it's going to sound like a little kid, but it feels like the best thing that we can do that we learn to improve youth police relations and interactions is just quit it. Just quit it. Cut it out. Minimize these encounters between black youth and police to the ones, only the ones that really have to occur, the ones that are necessary. Treat each and every person you encounter and we encounter with dignity and respect. Well, this doesn't sound radical. It actually requires a fundamental change of mindset. Because most police around the nation, most departments, we still train our police officers and our recruits in a military model designed to prepare them for combat, like that thin blue line. We need to stop looking at every young black kid out here like he or she is a potential enemy. We need to train our police to see our kids as just that, our children, all of our children. Police officers have got to see themselves as a part of the community. The more they treat people with dignity, again, the more effective they're going to be. Well, I've been talking a lot about the conversations that we've had with kids. I also mentioned the same time been having conversations with officers around the nation about the very same encounters, the same encounters you heard these kids talk about. In our conversations with young folks and police, they both depress me on one hand, and they also give me hope. Most kids and police tell me what you heard a lot of the kids say, They can't imagine anything different. Kids tell me, Mr. Futterman, maybe in your neighborhood, but that's fantasy land here. Honestly, police officers, most police officers tell me the same thing. They honestly can't see relationships with black youth changing. Police officers tell me that's the way it is too. It's been a long history of this. This didn't just start today. It's shared belief in the intractability of the issues. But I also hear from kids and police at the same time that they'd like things to be different, that they'd like things to be better, that they have a common interest and desire in better relations and trust between them. To me, that's real reason for hope. It feels like we've been stuck. I mean, I feel like we've been having the same conversation, long known what we got to do. I mean, the solutions that I've talked about, these aren't radical or new solutions. Honesty, transparency, accountability, basic trust, basic respect, dignity. Real question is, why haven't we acted before? Why do we continue to throw up our hands in futility when it comes to issues of race? What's up with our massive civic demoralization and defensiveness when it comes to issues of racism and white privilege? As a younger lawyer, I was struck by an observation by a character played by Ice Cube, of all folks, in John Singleton's 1990 or 91 movie, Boys in the Hood. Either they don't know, or they don't show what's going on in the hood. Either we don't know, or we don't care. Something changed after the release of that video of the killing of a 17-year-old boy in Chicago. The exposure of the cover-up of the shooting of Laquan pulled back the curtain on forms of structural violence built into all of our ongoing lives and made the realities of young black folks impossible to deny. Unchecked police abuse of black folks in Chicago, the police code of silence, basic truths. Cities and towns around the entire nation have now seen and know how police impunity works in Chicago. The curtain is up. We know. The question before us is, will we as a nation care enough to act on this truth? And sadly, the answer up until this point has been no. Not to be too Kanye, but as long as police brutality and the practices like stop and frisk remain concentrated in the hood, as long as the primary cost of our various wars on crime, on drugs, are borne by others, people of darker hues who live in places that we quote-unquote know to be dangerous, most white people in hell, if I'm going to be honest, all too many relatively privileged, all of us here, Jewish folk too, that we haven't cared enough to act. So I'm at U of C, and at U of C we're all skeptics. We're cynics about everything. And I've typically been skeptical about any notion of transformative change in times like these. But something, and I'm not one of those this is the moment kind of people either, but I'm about to say it because this moment feels like something that's different than I've experienced than anything in my lifetime. And I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because of our youth, because of the young people who sustain creative energies and activism have forced us to reckon with their realities. I'm also hopeful because of our police, the thousands of good police out there, the silent majority who hate police abuse as much as me or any of us. And I'm hopeful because this is the very first time in my life that there has been widespread acknowledgement that police abuse in black and brown communities is real and is systemic. I'm grateful to everybody here at JRC for having courage and having the leadership to have this kind of a conversation, to raise these fundamental questions. Youth-led movements have brought us to this moment, have brought us here, challenged our entire nation to care, to value each and every black life as our own. It's up to us to act on it. I'm glad to entertain any questions.